Welcome to Money for the Rest of Us Plus. This is the premium podcast episode for Plus members, episode 303, recording this Saturday morning, June 27th, 2020. In today's episode, we will review a brand new paper by research affiliates called Broken Asset Classes. We want to answer a member's question on how to analyze a social impact ETF. And finally, a question from another member on venture capital on a specific venture capital firm that's available to accredited investors for a minimum investment amount of only $100,000. First, just a quick announcement. Next Saturday is Independence Day here in the U.S., so it will not be a Plus episode. I will be releasing Plus episode 304, including the investment conditions commentary and the investment conditions report on Wednesday, July 8th. This paper by research affiliates, they define broken asset classes as asset classes that have underperformed severely in the bottom 10th percentile of the performance based on the previous 3 years, and where the media has essentially written the asset class off. In the paper, and I'll link to it, it gives the warning date and gives an example of a warning statement such as U.S. stocks back in August 1979, where there was an article in Business Week called The Death of Equities, and the warning was, for better or worse, the U.S. economy probably has to regard the death of equities as a near permanent condition. And there are some other examples. February 2000, small cap value is a dead asset class, which was followed by a very strong performance run for small cap value. What I found interesting about the paper is when the asset classes were declared dead or broken, it was typically comparing the returns relative to the S&P 500, so U.S. large company stocks. I neglected to mention the broken asset classes that they analyze. So U.S. stocks, real estate investment trusts, commodities, small value stocks, high yield bonds, value stocks in general, and emerging market stocks. So those asset classes had done very poorly relative to the S&P 500, generally below the 50th percentile. The performance relative to their actual history wasn't necessarily always that bad, and the absolute returns weren't that bad. REITs, for example, when they were declared dead in November 1998, had returned 13% annualized over the previous 3 years, and stocks had returned, U.S. stocks had returned 5%. The takeaway is, in the 5 years after the asset class was declared broken, they generally roared back and performed very well on an absolute basis. In fact, they went back and looked at not just the times where the asset class was declared broken, but they looked at all the periods where the three-year return was in the 10th percentile, so very poor relative to its history. And they found that 88% of the time, they went on to deliver a positive five-year return after that strong period of underperformance. And the average return was about 80%, which equates to 12% annualized. So the lesson is, asset classes will go through periods of underperformance. The media will often declare it dead. Frequently, the observation is not relative to the asset class's history, but relative to a mainstream stock benchmark like the S&P 500. And it pays to be patient with asset classes, particularly when we look at some of those asset classes now. Value investing has gone through a horrendous period of underperformance. But value is not dead, and at some point will rebound and will be rewarded. Next question is from a member who has been looking at ESG opportunities. These are environmental and social investments, and she has settled on a particular ETF that she's analyzing. And we'd like to know, how do you go about analyzing this type of ETF? The ETF is the iShares MSCI Global Impact ETF. Its objective is to match the performance of the MSCI All Country World Index Sustainable Impact Index. And that index is composed of companies that derive a majority of their revenue from products and services that address at least one of the world's major social and environmental challenges as identified by the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. This includes basic needs like nutrition, major disease treatment, sanitation, affordable real estate, empowerment issues like education, environmental issues like alternative energy, energy efficiency, green building, natural capital such as sustainable water, pollution prevention. That's the index. It's only been around about 4 or 5 years. And when looking at any ETF, there are certain things that you look at. One is the objective, which we just did. Two, the fees. In this case, this is a relatively more expensive exchange-traded fund at 0.49%. We want to see how big the ETF is with regards to overall assets to see if there's a risk of closure. In this case, there's $110 million in assets, which is on the low side for iShares, but given it's an ESG-related ETF, this is a trend that's just not going to go away. I suspect the ETF will be around a while. We want to consider how concentrated it is. What about its industry and geographical exposure? And the reason why we want to do that is if this is going to be an ETF that's going to anchor our stock portfolio, we want to make sure it's sufficiently diversified. And in this case, I don't think it is. There's 121 stocks, but the top 10 holdings comprise 37% of the overall ETF. For me, if this was my only stock allocation, that would be too concentrated. If we look at the overall weights, fairly significant underweight in financial services, 0.04%, compared to the overall stock market, which is 14.3%. It's overweight industrials, 23.8% versus 11.3% for the overall market. Also, significantly, surprisingly, underweight technology, 3.7% versus 18.8% for the overall stock market. Now, it's fine to have different weights relative to the overall stock market, but this is not a replication of the global stock market because it's more concentrated and it has sizable differences in terms of its sector allocation. Geographically, the ETF has about 33% in U.S. stocks and the rest in non-U.S., and that compares to the overall global stock market, which is about 55 to 57% U.S., so an investment in this particular ETF would be underweight the U.S. market. Now, this is a solid ETF that focuses on impact investing. We just want to look at how it differs from the overall global stock market so that when we see performance differences, we know why. It isn't because impact investing doesn't do as well as the global stock market. When we look at the MSCI All Country World Sustainable Impact Index, since inception, November 30th, 2015, it's returned 9.95% annualized versus the MSCI All Country World Index, which has returned 7.21% annualized. Now, we can't say that outperformance isn't because it's a social impact ETF or had it underperformed. We always want to look at how does it differ geographically and by industry, because that will be a big contributor to performance. But also there is some stock selection here with, again, the top 10 holdings comprising 37% of the ETF. Bottom line, then, it's a solid global impact investing ETF. Finally, I had a question from a member that was looking at Alumni Ventures Group, and they have a total access fund, and this is a way for individuals to get involved in investing in venture capital. Venture capital is an alternative investment in startup companies. We discussed alternative investments a few episodes ago in the regular podcast, and I mentioned five factors that will influence the return of alternative investments. The first is access to deal flow and the premier managers. The second is how much capital is flowing into the particular area, in this case, venture capital. The structure and fees of the particular partnership, including documentation. Incentives, how much does the manager have skin in the game? And what's the exit strategy? This particular venture firm mentions how they're co-investing alongside the premier venture capitalist. It's important to understand what co-investing means. Typically, when we think of co-investing, it's when a venture capital firm has invested in a startup company or a newer company, if we're looking at venture capital co-investing, and then allows its limited partners to invest in that same company, apart from the particular fund that they're in, so they can invest directly in that company. That's not what Alumni Ventures Group is doing. They're actually acting as a traditional venture capitalist, identifying startup companies and putting them in a fund. It just happens to be other venture capitalists also invest in those same startups. Alumni Ventures is sourcing the deals on their own. They're not getting the deals from other venture capitalists. They mention that they're one of the top three most active venture capitalists in the U.S. I don't necessarily consider that a positive, which is my biggest concern with this opportunity. It's great to be able to access venture capital deals with only $100,000. The total access fund has 200 to 300 holdings. There are other funds that are more alumni focused, so alumni from Brown University and others, and they've kind of built this network of alumni that are getting together, they're part of a community and helping to source deals. My biggest concern is there's just a lot of deals. So in 2018, this venture capital firm made 151 investments, 124 investments in 2017. They did 77 investments in 2019. Most venture capitalists are much more concentrated than that. They're not researching that many companies because they want to spend time helping and mentoring the individual companies. That's not the model that I see here. Now, they mentioned they have 50 investment professionals. I actually counted only 35 on their bios. This started in 2014. So their first fund was in 2014. So it's 6 years old, 14 investments, $885,000. Its total value to paid in capital. So what is the fund worth relative to the amount that was paid in? Net of fees is 1.9. So it's done well. Industry average for that vintage year was 1.55. Their second fund was 2015, 27 companies, $5 million invested. The total value to the amount paid in was 1.2. It's lagging the industry benchmark of 1.38. And then it's 2016 and 2017 funds. The value is less than what was paid in, and they're lagging the industry benchmark. Now, these funds are 10 years, so that's still early in the cycle. But each year, the funds are getting bigger. So the 2016 fund, they put 52 investments in. And as I mentioned, the 2017 fund, 124 investments. So they're doing a lot of deals. It's kind of like an index fund for venture capital. They're not able to put the level of due diligence on each individual opportunity that a traditional venture capital will do. They're clearly trying to grow their asset base. They're working with advisors, and they're acting like this is a way to invest in venture capital. And it is, but there's some challenges just because of the sheer number of deals that they're working through. The other interesting approach is they call all the capital at once. A traditional venture capital fund, you'll invest in the fund, and they'll call the capital over 4 to 5 years. In this case, they call it once. So you put in your money, and they charge 10 years worth of fees up front. So you invest $100,000, they'll immediately take out $20,000 for fees for the next 10 years. Now, they mentioned they don't charge any other fees, but that's an unusual structure. In this case, it kind of makes sense because their clients are not institutions. Individuals get into financial problems, and it would be difficult for them to be calling capital for future fees, and then people don't pay. So this is sort of a way you put all your money in once, they're going to reserve the fees. If the fund ends early, they'll refund some of the fees, but you're definitely paying all the fees up front. Unfortunately, there's just not a lot of ways for individuals to invest in venture capital. This is one way to do it. It's a little more institutional than some of the other platforms out there where you're just trying to pick an individual company to invest in. There's some level of due diligence, but it is not like an university endowment and their venture capital investments, because the venture capitalists will have much smaller portfolios, much more due diligence. Now, I've not looked at the bios of the individuals with regards to their experience. So if this is something you're considering, you'll need to spend way more time understanding the structure, the players, the companies, to see if this is something that you would consider. But the two things that stand out to me is the unusual fee structure and then just the sheer number of deals that they're putting in to these funds. That then is Plus Episode 303.